The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the July-August issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to go right to page 8, Who's Who in Sports. We're going to go to the second line, and we're going to start off with Crystal Dangerfield of the Minnesota Lynx, guard. A second-round draft pick out of UConn in 2020, Dangerfield went on to win the WNBA Rookie of the Year Award last season, capturing 44 of 47 votes. She led the Lynx in scoring 16.2 points per game and was third in the league in free throw shooting, 92.2%, as Minnesota had the WNBA's fourth best record. Crystal's height is 5'5". She was born May 11, 1998, in her hometown, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. But did you know Dangerfield was the first player not selected in the first round to be named WNBA Rookie of the Year since the award was established in 1998? Next, we have Vladimir Guerrero Jr. of the Toronto Blue Jays. He's the first baseman. His height is 6'2". His weight is 250 pounds. He was born March 16, 1999, in his hometown, Don Gregorio, Dominican Republic. Through 45 games, Guerrero was leading the American League with a .632 slugging percentage. He hit 13 home runs and drove in 36 runs while batting .331. Guerrero made his much-anticipated debut with the Blue Jays in 2019, hitting .272 with 15 home runs and finishing 7th in the American League Rookie of the Year voting. But did you know Guerrero's father hit 449 homers in his 16-year Major League career and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2018? And finally, we have Anastasia Webb, Oklahoma Sooners gymnast. Anastasia's height is 5'5". She was born June 15, 1999, in her hometown, Morton Grove, Illinois. As a senior, Webb won gold medals in the all-around floor exercise and vault at the 2021 NCAA Gymnastic Championships. She also won a bronze in the balance beam. Webb helped lead Oklahoma, the 2019 national champions, to a 30-2 record and a national runner-up finish. But did you know there are four apparatuses used in women's artistic gymnastics? Balance beam, uneven bars, floor exercise, and vault. Warm-up. What's your take? Do you have a question for Skip Shoremar, a complaint, a topic he should write about in a future issue? Send your letters to Kip's Treehouse-based editor at kip.shoremore@si.com. Hot take, Greek tragedy. The stadium looked like ancient history in 2014, 10 years after the Athens Games. No one should host the Olympics. The Olympics are like a hidden camera prank. It's great fun until it happens to you. The people of Japan are not happy that their country is hosting this summer's games. A poll released in May revealed that more than 80% of Japan opposed the Olympics proceeding as planned, with 43% wanting them canceled altogether. Who can blame them? Spending tens of billions of dollars to host people from other countries seems like a confusion of priorities as the country struggles to distribute COVID-19 vaccines. Fans hoping for fewer controversial post-pandemic games, however, should know that anti-Olympic demonstrations have already taken place in Paris, host of the 2024 games, and Los Angeles, the 2028. While the French protest group has a far superior name to the L.A. one, Saccage 2024, which means rampage in French, versus Nolympics L.A., their grievances are similar. Both groups fear that temporary accommodations made for temporary events will have lasting repercussions on the city's permanent residents. The French group highlights the ecological impact of building new structures on previously green spaces, while the LA organizers worry that the games will increase homelessness in the city. Take one glance at the stadium graveyard from past games, and their points start to make sense. Rio de Janeiro, host of the 2016 Olympics, has already let many of its stadiums fall into disrepair after just 5 years. While photos like the one on the previous page look like stills from an awesome post-apocalyptic video game, they're a harsh reminder of money that might have been better spent. Montreal's debt from the 1976 Olympics lasted well into the 21st century, and its Olympic Stadium, formerly the home of the Expos, has become a white elephant, a structure too expensive to maintain or destroy. So why in the wide world of sports do countries want, let alone bid, on the privilege of hosting the games? National pride plays a big role. The Olympics are an opportunity to present a country in its best light to a worldwide TV audience. And if run efficiently, the events can be a profitable tourist attraction. Ironically, given the current protests, the previous Tokyo and LA Olympics have long been held up as models for the benefits the event can provide. The 1964 Tokyo Games showed Japan as a peaceful modern superpower following a post-war malaise. The 1984 LA Games, which relied heavily on the city's existing sports infrastructure, turned a $250 million profit. But the world has changed since 1984. Maybe the Olympics just aren't worth the trouble anymore. Entertainment options are more fractured than ever. The 2018 Winter Olympics were the least watched on record in the United States. It's hard to stake your national pride on an opening ceremony if kids around the world aren't going to look up from watching Rubik's Cube solving videos on Twitch. Still, the Olympics are cool. The Summer and Winter Games are monuments to a shared humanity and universal love of creating big flames with smaller flames. Can the Olympics continue to inspire without getting bogged down in an endless cycle of protests? Yes, if they follow my simple plan for a permanent Olympic venue. If the games always happen in the same place, the cost would be lower. So who gets to be the full-time host? The all-time medal leader? That'd be the United States of America, of course, but that's not super convenient for the majority of the world's countries, which are in the other hemisphere. So let's go for the exact geographical center of all the countries on Earth. Calculated in 2003 to be north 40 degrees 52, east 34 degrees by 34, well, that leaves Turkey's Iskilip province. Sure, it's mountainous and isolated, landlocked, but who watches sailing anyway? I've already thought of a great Winter Olympics venue that's equally central on the globe. The South Pole. There's already even a bunch of different countries' flags there. What could go wrong? Go to page 14, August birthdays. Diamondback starter Madison Bumgarner is 32. August 4th, Washington Spirit and USWNT defender Kelly O'Hara is 33 years old. August 12th, Greek tennis star Stefanos Tsitsipas turns 23. And on August 21st, Bucks receiver Mike Evans is 28 years old. Aaron Rodgers won't be the last athlete to trade one buzzer beater for another. So here's our training course for would-be game show presenters. Host with the most. Number one, new episode outfit change. Athletes are used to wearing the same dirty dud for an entire game. But hosts film multiple episodes in a day and change clothes to give the illusion of time passing. Get that tie knot knotting time under 5 seconds or it's back to podcast narrating. Number two, pronunciation pop quiz. Not every game show requires a deep vocabulary. The toughest word on Supermarket Sweep is tortellini. But aspiring Jeopardy hosts need to nail foreign names in lines from classic literature. Remember, is Giannis Antetokounmpo. Number three, small talk gantlet. We're not writing small blurred for children's sports magazines. I am usually either organizing or painting my collection of model spaceships. Zoning out reading this? You're not going to make it in show business. A top flight presenter has witty response to any contestant's anecdote. Number four, timed podium dash. People aren't tuning in to see someone walk around. They're watching to see if they know more answers than the person on TV. Sure, navigating a tiny set sounds easy for a former athlete, but well-tailored clothes are not as forgiving as shorts. Number 5, calculating final scores. Quarterbacks have a knack for knowing when they're down in a game by any multiple of 7 of 3. But if Susie wagers half of 44,356 that the capital of Burma is Yangon, does she beat Ralph? No, the capital of Burma is Naypyidaw. Number 6, loser consolation. Your life's dream as a pro athlete was to lead the Pirates to the World Series. Their dream as a contestant was to shake your hand triumphantly during reruns on the game show network. Let them down easy. After all, you know what it's like to lose. You were one of the Pirates. And finally, number 7, parking lot obstacle course. Finally, a skill that translates from an athletic career, avoiding people who want to express their love for you. Pro tip, don't park in the spot right by the studio door that screams VIP. Try to sneak out the back and watch out for tours. Page 23. What if Barry Bonds had been a Brave? Imagine any great player, and here's a picture of Barry Bonds in an Atlanta Braves uniform. Imagine any great player who never won a ring joining a would-be dynasty, and you have a classic what-if scenario. What if Charles Barkley had been shipped to the Jazz? What if Dallas had traded Jerome Ingala to Dominic Hasek's Sabres instead of the Flames? In baseball, the ultimate such scenario is not so fanciful. Before the 1992 season, the Braves and Pirates agreed to a trade that would have sent Barry Bonds to Atlanta. At the time, Bonds seemed like the final piece for a team that had lost the 91 World Series. Then, at the last minute, the deal collapsed when Pirates manager Jim Leyland objected. Bonds and the Braves won a combined one championship, Atlanta's 1995 title, during the span of the Slugger's career. But together, their dominance seems less hypothetical than mathematically inevitable. From 1992 to 2007, Atlanta won 1,500 games, more than any other team. Over the same span, Bonds accumulated 121.5 wins above replacement. What's more, Atlanta was not giving up any key members of his team. The deal the Pirates agreed to would have netted them reliever Alejandro Pena, outfielder Keith Mitchell, and a prospect to be named later. Despite hitting .318 in 48 games with the Braves in 1991, Mitchell would play most of his career in the minors. Pena and Anchor on some great Dodgers teams in the 80s experienced a sharp decline starting in 1992. Unless the prospect to be named was named Chipper, Atlanta would have fleeced the Pirates. Sending Barry Bonds to Atlanta, however, wouldn't be a case of simple addition. Bonds was one of the most controversial players of his era, and one of the highest paid, too. His presence would have altered the direction of the franchise and the record books. Numbers game. Barry Bonds boasts the most cartoonish stats ever to grace the back of a baseball card. His .362, .609, .812 slash line from 2004 is no less absurd to the modern fan than old Hoss Radbourne's 60 wins and .678 two-thirds innings pitched in 1884. Individual players rarely improve a team by more than 2 or 3 wins in a single season, but the home run king's outlier numbers would have filled some serious holes in Braves manager Bobby Kotick's lineups. In 2002, Chipper Jones moved from third base to left field to accommodate aging slugger Vinny Castilla. Jones kept hitting, but Castilla was a disaster, posting a meager .268 on-base percentage. That same season, Bonds set the all-time record for on-base percentage with .582. The Braves won 100 games in 2008, but WAR estimates that Bonds was worth 13 wins than Castilla. With an outfield of Bonds, Andrew Jones, and Gary Sheffield, Atlanta could have broken Seattle's record of 116 regular season wins just a year after it was set. Of course, the Braves had no idea of regular season success. The game they were truly worried about winning was the last one of the season. Excluding 1994, which was shortened by a strike, the Braves made the playoffs in 14 straight seasons. The Braves lost 5 division series, 4 league championships, and 4 World Series. Barry Bonds had a poor reputation as a clutch hitter in 92, batting 148 against Atlanta in the 91 NLCS and 167 the year before against Cincinnati. With just 1 year left in his contract in 1992, Bonds would have had exactly one playoff run to impress his new team. But if Bonds hit in the postseason, the cost of keeping him for the Braves would have only gone up. The 6-year, $43.75 million the slugger signed with the Giants in 93 was, at the time, the most lucrative in baseball history. Trading for him would have given the Braves a year to try to sign him. But in an open market, Atlanta couldn't compete with San Francisco, the town where Bonds' dad, Bobby, and grandfather, Willie Mays, had played. So the Braves went after the top pitcher, free agent of the 93 offseason, Greg Maddux. Had the Braves gotten Bonds, they would have missed out on arguably the most dominant trio of pitchers ever assembled, Maddux, Jim Smoltz, John Smoltz, and Tom Glavine. And while his stats are not as obscene as Bonds eventually would be, Maddux contributed more than the slugger would have in the short term, winning 3 straight Cy Young Awards and propelling them to that 1995 title. In this way, the question of what would have happened if Barry Bonds had been traded to the Braves is a more elemental question. Hitting or pitching? Did the Braves win a World Series because pitching wins in the playoffs and they had 3 aces? Or did they miss out on a dynasty because their lineup couldn't keep up? Like all philosophical dilemma, it can only be answered by video games. Digital dynasty. To better understand what might have been for the Braves, I turned once again to Text Simulator Out of the Park Baseball's historical replay mode. My mission was simple. I accepted the Atlanta GM job, made the Bonds for Peña trade, signed him to a 10-year extension, used the executive bathroom, and promptly quit, all in the same virtual day. Then, as an unemployed non-player character, I simply watched what happened. My computer successor was allowed to make ahistorical trades and signings under the constraints of a post-Bonds budget. But the Braves got their real-life rookies, like Chipper Jones. Player ratings were also recalculated before every season using real-world stats to override the game's natural player aging algorithm and better simulate any late career, perhaps pharmaceutically aided improvements. These fictional Braves made the playoffs in 3 fewer seasons but won 5 World Series in 1992, 93, 01, 02, and 03. Those 5 specific years makes their new left fielder's impact obvious. They won multiple rings during Bonds' twin MVP winning peaks, during his late 20s and again during his late 30s. Amazingly, this Barry Bonds never hit more than 43 home runs in a single season. To simulate his record-breaking season in Atlanta, something more powerful than a video game is required. Imagination. Hall pass. Barry Bonds is not in the Hall of Fame. 4 members of the 1995 Braves are. World Series rings aren't responsible for either situation, but more than success could have helped Bonds' case. As it stands, Cooperstown voters can paint the picture of a me-first player, a guy who had 4 lockers and a lounge chair in the Giants' dressing room, a guy who allegedly used performance-enhancing drugs to chase individual records, but as a member of a Braves dynasty, the home run king's legend might be too big to deny. Even his pursuit of Hank Aaron's career long ball record would have seemed more wholesome, framed as the passing of the torch between 2 legendary Braves outfielders. Still in the end, maybe this is a scenario both parties prefer as a whimsical alternate history. At his stance, Bonds became a legend on his dad's old team, and the Braves remained one of the few powerhouses of that era, untainted by steroid scandals. There's room enough in the hall for everyone. Moving on to our posters, we have Angels pitcher and outfielder Shohei Ohtani. He's also the designated hitter. Fast facts. Any question about whether the two-way star had recovered from the arm injury that shortened his 2020 season were answered in the Angels' fourth game. When Ohtani threw a 100.1 mile per hour pitch and hit a home run with an exit velocity of 115.2 mile per hour. Through June 9th, he was second in the AL with 17 homers and had a 2.76 ERA in 8 starts. Next, we have the GOAT, the Olympic GOAT, Simone Biles, United States gymnast. Fast facts, the most decorated gymnast in United States history. Biles has won 5 Olympic and 25 World Championship medals. She can break the all-time record for combined medals by winning 4 more this month at the Tokyo Games. Biles has 4 moves named after her in the Women's Artistic Gymnastics Code of Points. And in May, she became the first woman to land a Yurchenko double pike vault, which has the highest degree of difficulty in the sport. Continuing with our gymnastic preview, page 33. In August 2016, Simone Biles stood atop the podium in Rio de Janeiro, beaming and holding up 4 fingers. She had just won gold in the floor exercise, sending her home from her first Olympics with 4 gold medals and 1 bronze. It was a masterful performance. But looking back on it, Biles says she barely enjoyed those games. She was so focused on pleasing the rest of the world. In the balance beam final, she missed the landing on the front tuck and grabbed the beam, an automatic 0.5-point deduction that led to her third-place finish. I was so happy that I even medaled because of the mistake that I had, but I felt so ashamed because people were mad that I ruined their headline of 5 gold medals, she says. The Tokyo Olympics give Biles a chance to add to her haul and maybe have a little more fun. But the postponement of the game for a year last summer because of the COVID-19 pandemic presented another challenge. Biles has been racing against time, trying to force one last transcendent performance from a body that is ready to find a different career. Now that body would have to endure an additional 12 months. She told her training partner, "I just don't know if I can do this for another year." Well, she did, of course, and it was a typical GOAT-worthy year. In May at the United States Classic, she landed a Yurchenko double pike vault, something no woman gymnast had ever so much as attempted. The next month, she won her 7th all-around title at the United States Gymnastics Championship and added gold in 3 individual disciplines as well. Biles heads to Tokyo as the owner of 30 world championship and Olympic medals. She also has 4 skills named after her. The kind of dominance that makes opponents agree that second place is a gold medal in the non-Biles division. She needs 4 more medals to pass Vitaly Sherbo, who competed for the Soviet Union, as the most decorated gymnast of all time. She knows it won't be easy. Even before the delay, Biles would have been an adult in a teenager sport. She was 23 last summer. Only 4 female gymnasts have won gold at 23 or older since 1972, and the oldest individual all-around gold medalist since then was 20. While Biles is old for a gymnast, she knows she's still young enough to have a whole other life in front of her. She dreams of her own TV show, and she knows she wants to work with foster kids in some capacity, in a nod to her own upbringing. Her parents adopted her and her sister, Adria. Yeah, Biles says, that's a big task, making sure it goes up from there. Don't bet against her. Continuing with the Olympic preview, page 34 and 35, karate, first, last chance. Stop trying to impress everyone by calling yourself a longtime Olympic karate fan. The sport is making its debut at these games, and sadly, it's not on the slate for Paris 2024. Athletes will compete in 2 forms. Kumite, a sparring event, and kata, a solo form. The U.S.'s best hope to medal is Sakura Kokomai, who will compete in kata. She was actually living in Tokyo when her sports inclusion was announced. She quit her job and moved in with the host family in California to start training by herself. She took the train to meet with a strength coach in San Diego, sometimes sleeping on the gym floor. In a sport not flush with sponsorship dollars, Kokomai has sacrificed plenty for what may be her only shot at Olympic glory. Volleyball. Soccer's World Cup always features its fair share of impact players who play for a country other than where they are born. But it's hard to imagine, for example, Cristiano Ronaldo playing for a team other than his native Portugal. That's why it's so intriguing that the Cristiano Ronaldo of volleyball, Wilfredo Leon, will represent Poland despite being born in Cuba. Leon left his birth nation in 2013 and became a Polish citizen in 2015. Leon and his new team lost to defending Olympic champs Brazil in the 2019 World Cup, also in Japan. Brazil and China, the reigning women's winner from Rio, are favored to repeat, but Leon will give Poland a chance at its first medal in the sports since it won gold in 1976. Skateboarding. United States gymnasts boasted a fierce five. Brazilian skateboarding is about to introduce the Thrasher 3. I just coined that. Copyright. It's like, kids, I don't want to see it on the T-shirts. Raisa Leal on the right, fist pumping, age 13. Pamela Rosa on the right, holding flag, age 21. And Leticia Buffoni, 28, will compete against each other in the women's street event. Buffoni is favored to win, but a podium sweep for Brazil is possible. In men's street, American Naya Houston is a contender. He'll be challenged by Tokyo's hometown hero, Yuto Horigome. The other skateboarding event is Park, in which Finnish American phenom Lizzie Armanto will represent Finland. That makes us Americans sad, but we still wish her the best. Surfing. There will be plenty of top United States surfers to support in these games, including John Florence and Carissa Moore. The easiest athlete to root for, however, might be Australia's Owen Wright. The Aussie was a title contender during the inaugural World Surf League in 2015. But before the last event of the tour, he wiped out at Hawaii's Banzai Pipeline and suffered a serious brain injury that caused him to miss the entire 2016 season in the recovery. After having to relearn how to walk, Wright returned in 2017 and won at Australia's Snapper Rocks. Now he'll go for the storybook ending at Sagursakai Beach as the sport makes its Olympic debut. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.